Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, March 13th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly take on the news media comes to you from the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at RJI. J-School colleague Lee Wilkins is here, and sitting in for Charles Davis this week is a special guest panelist, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and PBS documentary producer Hedrick Smith. Smith's latest book is Who Stole the American Dream? He's speaking about it tonight at RJI as our show airs, so we thought we'd give you a preview and get his take on a few other hot topics involving journalists. Well, Hedrick, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you, Mike.
Well, first, let's lay out the central premise of your book, Who Stole the American Dream? You report that 40 years, essentially, of corporate lobbying, government actions have created essentially what you call two Americas. So how did we get there, and what do these two Americas look like?
Well, we got to remember that we used to have an America where wealth was widely shared, where the middle class really, when productivity went up 97% in the 30 years after World War II, middle class living standards went up 95%. Okay. Since then, productivity has gone up 80%, but middle class living standards have only gone up 10%. So that's how we got to be two Americas. That happened both politically, you were suggesting that, and economically. In politics, what happened was we got a power shift. Used to have middle class power, consumers movement, women's movement, labor movement, environmental movement, civil rights movement, all of which expanded and protected the living standards of the middle class. There was a reaction by the bosses. The bosses' revolt, triggered by Lewis Powell's famous memorandum. Lewis Powell, the guy who was named to the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon, was a corporate attorney. He was worried about what was happening to American business and said, you got to get into the political arena. And his memo, circulated by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, triggered a revolt of the bosses, a real power shift. 9,000 corporate lobbyists, 50,000 people working for business trade associations, unbelievable lobbying power moved into Washington in the 1970s, and we're still living with that today. So that's one thing. The other thing that happened was business leaders used to believe in what they called stakeholder capitalism. Give a part of the earnings and the profits and the growth to all the stakeholders in the corporation, that is the workers as well as the owners, the customers, the clients, the communities that businesses operated in. We shifted to shareholder capitalism, Milton Friedman's idea. Maximize shareholder return. Give everything that you can to the people who own the company. Big dividends, jack up the stock price. When you start doing that, you put pressure down on wages. And so the middle class stuck even. As I mentioned, they didn't go up very much. At the top, 600% increase in income, the top 1%. Corporate CEOs went from 40 times average workers' earning to nearly 400 times average workers' earning. So in brief, that's what happened. Two things, wedge economics and a power shift in Washington.
And in your book, some folks have suggested that, of course, you are a master of the facts. You did a lot of digging and added to some of the things you've been reporting for the past several years. Some folks even suggested maybe it was too many facts and not enough passion. I'm just wondering if you could give us a couple of very specific examples, though, of how real people were affected and how you documented that.
I don't think many people who've read that book say there's not enough passion. When I got done writing the book, my editor, Kate Medina at Random House, said, Rick, you've got so much anger in this book, we're going to have to take some anger out, or people are going to be more angry at you than they are at the facts. Well, take a guy like Pat O'Neill. Pat O'Neill was a jet airline mechanic for United Airlines for 35 years. Farm boy who looked up in the sky and said, I know how to fix tractors, but I'd love to learn how to fix those planes up there. So he went and got himself an airline mechanic training, and he worked the graveyard shift at O'Hare. Cold, wintry, windy weather, miserable conditions, making sure that when you and I flew through O'Hare, the planes were flying the next morning. Okay, he gets ready to retire in 2003 after 35 years. And what happens? United declares bankruptcy. Boom. His 401k collapses in half. His employee stock ownership program goes from $80,000 to $2,000 in value. His pension, his lifetime pension, which had been guaranteed by the union contract, gets cut by $1,000 a month. Pat O'Neill can't retire. He's got to go back to work. He becomes a long-haul truck driver, gets sick of that. His kidneys are killing him. He's spending 6 days a week away from his wife. He can't stand all the travel. So he quits, sets up his own lawn mowing company. Then he runs for county office in eastern Washington and gets elected a county commissioner. I got a phone call from Pat O'Neill literally last week. Pat O'Neill figures he will never be able to retire. Millions of Americans who've worked very hard all their lives now figure they will never be able to retire. And worse, he just lost his job as county commissioner and he can't find work. So we're talking about real live people that are going through that by the millions. Just last week, the New York Times reported corporate profits since the bottom of the recession went up 20% a year. Average salaries, wages went up 1.4% a year. Wall Street's going through the top. Main Street's still stuck with 22 million people looking for full-time jobs. I mean, the figures and the human stories are dramatic. You know, when you're talking about somebody who's worked at Pat O'Neill's now in his late 60s, this is a guy who's worked all his life. He played by the rules. He did what was expected of him. He showed up every night, and now he's stuck.
Lee, jump in on the conversation here.
Well, in the process, you brought up the New York Times, and that was actually where I wanted to go a bit, because your book covers a lot of things happening, a lot of things that were within public view. But by and large, they weren't reported very much. They certainly weren't reported aggressively. And they certainly, to take the New York Times as an example, the New York Times has a great business section. It has no labor section. So how much of the problem is what we journalists failed to do at a time when it might have made a difference?
It continues to make a difference today. We journalists failed. I don't think there's any question that we failed. Listen, I ran the Washington Bureau of the New York Times in the late 70s. The Powell Memo was written in the early 70s. It had a direct, powerful impact on the policies under Jimmy Carter while I was the Washington Bureau Chief. I can tell you, I never heard of the Powell Memo until I did the research on this book. Not a single reporter in my bureau ever heard it. I gave a talk in Washington just about 10 days ago at the home of Mark Shields, the syndicated columnist for the Washington Post. People like Bob Schieffer of CBS News and Jim Blair of PBS, people like that were there. There was only one other journalist in the room who'd ever heard of the Powell Memo, which had dramatic impact. There's no question. We have not been – I mean, part of it was that was circulated. Privately, it was kept secret. But part of the problem today, Lee, I believe, is that we are so focused on winning this news cycle, getting the blog out that's going to matter in the next 30 minutes or the next 3 hours, that we don't take time to do what I've done in this book and which needs to be done on a much more regular basis. I don't mean book size, but getting into the kind of depth you're talking about. We're not doing it. We are failing our public. We are bombarding them with bits of information they can't understand and they don't know how to put together. We're not connecting the dots for people. That's our biggest failure.
Well, let's bring your findings in sort of the current debate. You suggested in a Politico column you wrote about a month or so ago that history might be, quote, moving in the direction of President Obama and his reform agenda. And other than, you know, him being reelected, I don't know that it feels that way, at least as the way the media are portraying the current debate over the budget fight, for example.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you bringing that up. What I was talking about was a riptide. I'm happen to be a sailor, and so I'm interested in the water and oceans. A riptide is at the moment when the tide is changing. And if you look at the surface of the water, it's swirling around. You can't tell which way it's going. And the reason is on the surface, the tide is going one way and underneath it's going the other way. OK, that's what I was. So I was raising the question, are we watching a riptide in history? If you look at American history over time, we tend to swing from a period of progressivism to conservatism every 35, 40 years. We're about 35 years out since the change came back in the late 1970s, the time period I was talking about. So question, has it begun to run out? Well, if you go back a year ago, the Republicans expected to win the presidency. The Republicans expected to take control of the Senate. And they were very confident they were going to hang on to the House of Representatives. Well, they lost the presidency. The Democrats actually increased their hold on the Senate. And in the House vote, there were actually more people who voted Democratic than voted Republican. But because of gerrymandering, the Republicans have a 33-vote seat in the House. Now, don't take my word for it, but when you get Haley Barbour, the former Republican national chairman, governor of Mississippi, and Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, two very conservative Republicans saying, either one says we're a stupid party or the other says the demographics are going against us. The Republican stronghold is with white males, a shrinking part of the electorate. The Democratic strongholds have been with the young, the blacks, the Latinos, and women, which are growing in the electorate. So there's some political indicators that may indicate that last year's elections are only a partial indication. Then in policy terms, we have never had an expansion of the safety net since 1965. Obamacare, embattled as it is, imperfect as it is the first expansion of the safety net in roughly 40 years, not quite 40 years. And you've got other indicators out there. I'm not saying it's happened. I'm saying we are confused by what we're watching. And we need at least to raise questions to whether or not some of the stuff on the surface doesn't really reflect what Lee was suggesting our job is a moment ago, that we need to be looking underneath to see what's going on underneath.
Well, one of the things I was interested in your book is you spend the last – what I took as the last two chapters talking about a set of solutions. And some of those solutions are political and some of those solutions are policy-oriented.
Right.
But none of them focused on what it is that journalists could be doing and what it is that we might be out here in the heartland teaching our students about how to look at things differently, how to analyze things differently, how to conceptualize stories differently. So that, in fact, you know, when we write about labor, we're not always just writing about strikes, that we're writing about, you know, things that actually matter to people in a different way now.
Well, I would happily – I may go on and write another book about journalism. I would happily have added a chapter of journalism to this book, but it's already a fairly long book. But let me just kick in what I would have said. Number one, I really would say that we have got to stop this short-termitis that we have in journalism. People are too concerned. I mean, if you look at blogs on the internet, there is so much useless garbage there, which is mostly focused on what's happened in the last 20 hours – not even 24 hours, and going over it with a fine-tooth comb rather than sitting down and saying, well, people are saying that if you lower the tax rate, it will increase growth. That's a pretty fundamental fact you could go out and check. I don't see many medium do it. There was a story by Eduardo Porter in the New York Times this morning, a column by him saying that historical track record shows that, in fact, lowering taxes does not increase growth and that high taxes don't inhibit growth. Now, I wrote the same thing in my book a year and a half ago, so you could have found it out before today. But I don't know. Why don't we do fact-checking on political statements between elections, not just during the campaign? So we could do that. Number two, we need to be looking at people like Pat O'Neill. We need to be looking at the human stories of what, in fact, is happening, what lies behind the numbers. And there are people doing it. It's not that it's not going on at all. It is happening in very good newspapers like the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and good magazines. And it's happening some places on radio, far less on television. But we do need to take the time to actually connect the dots, give people the meaning, translate the headlines into how they actually affect people's lives. And I hope and I'm sure this is what you're trying to teach people. The difficulty is when they get out into the arena, the pressure is to get the ratings up, get a bigger audience today. If it bleeds, it leads. You know, if you can get extreme positions on both sides shouting at each other, you think you're going to get a better rating whether you're running Fox or MSNBC. So we get highly polarized news coverage. We get highly polarized politics. And in fact, we don't move towards solutions in this country. And we journalists don't pay a lot of attention to the people in the middle because they're sort of reasonable and they're quiet and they say, I'll take a bit from this side and a bit from that side. And that's not exciting. Well, we need to train ourselves not to be so excited by excitement and titillation, but more interested in what's actually going to affect democracy and the way it works in this country.
Well, we talk to our journalism students a lot about the extent to which a journalist should be advocating particular prescriptions for problems, and you have a 10-point plan in your book. Even a lot of folks who agree completely with your analysis say it sounds pretty much like a standard, quote, progressive 10-point plan. So one, is that fair? And two, should you as a journalist be taking a position on these very specific suggestions for solving the problem?
What a great question. I had an argument with my editor about this. When I finished the first draft, the last two chapters weren't there. And she said, Rick, you have drawn a picture of how this nation got itself in a ditch. You've got to help people get out. I said, Kate, I'm a journalist. I'm not a policy wonk. I don't sit in Congress. It's not my responsibility to come up with an energy policy or a jobs policy or a tax policy. So, no, I'm not going to do it. She said, listen, you're trying to get out and talk to people about how democracy and how our economy can work better. You must have some ideas. And we fought back and forth. And my wife, who is actually my first reader, Susan Zox, and my first editor said, Kate's right, Rick, you've got to do it. So reluctantly, and when I talk to audiences, I say, you have Hedrick Smith's happy 10-point plan to cure America's ills. I feel awkward about it, in all honesty. But I am a citizen as well as a journalist, and there's no question this is editorial comment. It is not where I 26 years at the New York Times, I clearly separated in my own mind and my daily behavior for 26 years, and then on into PBS making documentaries, separated the news pages from the editorial pages. In this book, at the end of this book, I violated that journalistic canon, and I plead guilty. But I have to say that I think that we need as a nation, and here I'm talking as a citizen rather than as a journalist, we have to try to figure out things that are smart. And I did. It is a fairly progressive agenda, although there are plenty of Republicans who back this. I mean, I'm talking about rebuilding the infrastructure in America, which is costing us our competitiveness, hurting our industry and so forth. You know, got Arnold Schwarzenegger, former governor of California, and John Rendell, former governor of Pennsylvania, one Republican, one Democrat. You've got Kay Bailey Hutchison, former Republican senator from Texas, and John Kerry, former Democratic senator from Massachusetts. You got the AFL-CIO and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce on both sides, all saying we got to do something about our infrastructure. You got both sides saying we got to do something about the corporate tax code. I'm saying you got to lower the rates and close the loopholes. The Republicans are saying lower the rates. The Democrats are saying close the loopholes. So this is a much more centrist agenda than it actually appears to be on the surface of it. But I wasn't trying to push it one way or another. I was trying to do something that I thought was important, which is how do we get the American economy moving again? How do we help the middle class? I will plead guilty to being an advocate for the American middle class. Don't think that's such a bad idea. I remember at graduate school studying Jeremy Bentham, the great British 19th century philosopher. Greatest good for the greatest number is what our society, our economy, our politics should be about. I'll plead guilty. If that's taking sides, I'll plead guilty to that.
Well, let's have you put your journalism hat back on for a second rather than your citizen hat and talk about the impact of the changes we've seen in long-form journalism, especially on television. Obviously, you've done a lot of work in that field with your frontline documentaries. Are you concerned at all that we've essentially abandoned long-form television journalism?
I absolutely am. There's no question about it. I mean, the networks have clearly abandoned it, except for very occasionally you get an anchor doing some kind of special after an election or when there's a summit visit going on, the president's going to go to China or something like that. Yes, I think it's terrible. And the reason why it's important is what I was saying earlier to Lee. People can't make sense of things unless you sit down and tell them a story. That's what I've tried to do in this book, Who Stole the American Dream? It's a narrative. It's a story. It fits it together. Long-form journalism can do that. The other thing about long-form journalism is it's really interesting, and I learned this. I went from print to video. It was quite an adjustment, quite a change for me. But what I found out was if you're going to do an hour's program, and you're really going to do a significant hours program, you have got to be teaching somebody something new, everybody something new, every 5 or 6 minutes. And I sat as a judge on Emmys after I won a couple of Emmys, and I saw how many pieces were coming in long form, either 20 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, hour and a half, how repetitive they were, how they weren't taking people a step further. They were repeating the same themes in the second half hour that you'd learned in the first half hour. That's not effective. But the key is money. The key is people. The key is talent. The networks just simply don't want to do it. Cable almost never does it. I mean, it's left essentially to Frontline, PBS, and not many other outlets doing it.
Well, as you probably know, we're the home, we meaning Columbia, is the home of the True False Documentary Film Festival, which you've missed by about 10 days. And one of the things that our students here are very interested in, and one of the things a couple of the docs that I saw reminded me of something that I watched of yours called Poison Waters, right, which was a documentary about water quality that you did several years ago, is some of that long form, I think, is migrating to documentary film.
That,
as other places have sort of closed down. down. It's moved to documentary film, but those folks generally conceive of themselves as filmmakers and artists and not as journalists. And so some of what comes out is a really interesting blend of it's part art, it's part journalism, but it's not something that's easily categorized for those of us who've spent our lives
in
the profession.
Well, I think it's wonderful that those films are being made, but the difficulty is they're being shown to several hundred people at film festivals. And if they go to 20 film festivals, then maybe, I don't know, 8,000-10,000 people, if they're lucky, see them. I mean, at Frontline, which does not have a huge audience, at least you've got 1 million or 2 million people watching. They usually put them up online, and another several hundred thousand people. We did a program called Is Walmart Good for America? Frontline ran that four times. Each time it had an audience of about 2 or 3 million people. Four times we're up to 12 or 13 million people. 1 million people have seen that online. It's now had a significant audience. And I think the work you're talking about is important. It's wonderful. It's creative. Those are enormously dedicated people. That's extremely hard work, and it's very hard work to raise the money to be able to make those films. And then they got to trot around the film festivals. My hat is off to them. They're doing great work. But what kind of impact is it having on people's knowledge about the world around them? Poison Waters was basically saying 35 years after the Clean Water Act was passed, the quality of our water is now deteriorating again. It improved for a while after the Clean Water Act, for a decade or so, then it leveled off, and now it's getting worse. That's a very important thing for people to know and to understand. If only a few hundred people are seeing that at a film festival, it's not likely to have much political and policy impact. That's why I agreed with Mike earlier that the demise of this on the networks and the lack of it on cable is really terrible, because people are making decisions and reacting to policies without information. And what's going on in those documentary films is important information, however it's approached, however artistic or creative. Great for them.
Let me have you give a bit of a reaction briefly about a particular long-form journalist and a contemporary of yours who's been in the news the past couple of weeks, Bob Woodward. He's come in for his fair share of abuse, I would say. Some would say it was self-induced. I think we all agreed that he exaggerated a bit about how discomforted he was by the White House's so-called threat. But still, it strikes me at least that there's been a bit of piling on. And there was a four-page Newsweek piece this past week where Max Holland said that the Woodward incident, quote, revealed a grotesquely swollen ego fed by 40 years of hero worship. Another journalist, Tanner Colby, over at Slate was saying that Woodward failed as a journalist because he cares more about facts than people. What's your take on that?
Well, Woodward is a great reporter and has demonstrated that over time, but that doesn't mean that he produces the same quality journalism all the time. My reaction to The Price of Politics was I'd read it all before. Okay, so it's not about ego worship or narcissism or whatnot. I think that he didn't have a great story to tell, and that's part of the problem there. I mean, I think so, the stuff that Matt Bai did in the New York Times Magazine on the it's basically examining the fiscal cliff battle back in the 2011 and who's to blame. I do think that part of what we have here, and this goes back to Lee's question about what journalists should do, there's a lot of fascination among some people with inside baseball. And that is not talking about where people's lives are. There's a huge difference between what Bob Woodward has written, not to knock him, but to talk about the genre of reporting. It's about who maneuvered whom, who said what to whom, and how the deal broke down inside Washington. It is real inside stuff. I don't think that actually informs the public very much about how policy gets made. I've tried to do something very different. I've tried to go and tell you about the policy battles, but also go back into the country and look at their impact, and then go from homeowners to regional banks to Wall Street to regulators back down to homeowners and the living standards of the middle class. I think I was a foreign correspondent. I got trained as a foreign correspondent. What that means is when you go into a country, you cover the whole country. You don't just cover the capital. You cover the capital and the way it relates to the country. What's wrong with the Washington Press Corps, and I've believed this for 30 years, is that it's all focused in Washington and those guys and gals rarely ever get out in the country. And the people out in the country, they rarely get to Washington. So to go back to your question of what we cover, you need good managing editors. You need good executive producers who say to Washington correspondents, okay, you've been covering healthcare, you've been covering taxes, you've been covering business versus labor. Get out and go to Detroit, go to Hartford, go to Texas, go to Connecticut, and link up what you've been reporting about policy in Washington with what's going on in the country. I think that would be a terribly important thing for this journalism school here to be teaching people to expect of themselves and their bosses and their institutions. That, to me, is a much more fundamental critique, not just of Woodward, but of that kind of book, which is Washington Inside Dope.
Well, I suspect we'd come in for a bit of criticism if we didn't at least mention this week the fact that as we were coming into the studio to record the program, the Catholic Church was announcing that the College of Cardinals had, in fact, elected a new pope. He's going to be called Pope Francisco. He's Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio from Argentina. We can't tell you much more than that at the moment because the story is breaking as we're recording. But starting with you, Lee, just some basic reaction to how the media has done in covering this story leading up to today's selection.
Well, this is going to be a little bit of same song, second verse, because I think in some ways who becomes pope, particularly with the process that the Vatican has for selecting that person, it's a true horse race. And we've covered it just like a horse race. And that's a problem because I think it's different than just merely who leads this very powerful and influential organization. It's also about the troubles within that organization and how that person is going to be able or not so able, as it turns out, to cope with them. So I compliment us on our horse race coverage. I hope that in the coming days and weeks and months that we will be able to find some ways to dig in on what's behind the horse race, you know, whether or not the Vatican has been laundering money, which has been asserted in some European media, what in the world they're going to do about the continuing scandal about pedophile priests, the role of women in the church. All of those things are things, stories that are yet to be written that I think are like way more important than just the name of the man who is the next pope.
So maybe we had the name of the man and we had the scandals. What else do we need
to
know?
I don't think I'd agree with Lee. I, as a non-Catholic and somebody who doesn't normally follow religious news, I think the business about the scandals, the position of women in the church, the pedophilia certainly has been covered amply for a long time. But I think even the leaks within the Vatican that came out, I mean, I think there's been really good coverage. We know that the Catholic Church is an institution that is in great trouble. We also know that roughly half of the cardinals who elected the new pope were cardinals picked by Pope Benedict, who was not a good papal administrator, who was not a charismatic figure like John Paul. So we know what the dilemmas are. So we're watching this new leader emerge in the Catholic Church, and we got some pretty good background information. I think we're better informed actually about the problems of the pope, maybe not about the pope himself, but the problems of the pope, than often we are about a president and presidential candidates. I mean, if I go back and think about the coverage of George W. Bush as a candidate in the election of 2000, his record in Texas was not very well examined by the American media. A lot of what he did as president was foreshadowed by what he did as governor, and we didn't cover it. I think we've done a better job, or not we, other people have done a better job covering the problems of the pope.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have this week. A special thanks to Hedrick Smith for joining us. You can visit his website, hedricksmith.com. Links there to his writings, his frontline documentaries, and more. If you'd like links to this program, of course, visit our blog under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. You can also replay this in past episodes, leave us questions, comments, topic suggestions, or if you'd prefer, you could send them via email to views@kbia.org. Our technical team is director Travis McMillan and audio engineer Pat Akers. I'm Mike McKean. Join Charles Davis, Lee Wilkins, and me next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.